longer you're out, the more you've forgotten. And I think that's what basically happened to me. Carlos scored his first goal, if you can believe it. I think it was his first goal in 20 games. I mean, how can Carlos Tevez go 20 games without scoring? But he scored. Charlton fans, I think I had 14 attempts of trying to take someone from Man United and got nothing. And then I went to West Ham and won 3 on the spin, which was really enjoyable, I must admit.
Hello and welcome along to the latest edition of the From the Horse's Mouth podcast. In keeping with our traditions of Mondays, we're going to chat to another big name in sport. As I attempt to shut my mouth, I hand you over to the capable hands of Patrick Power and Rupert Walsh in conversation with Alan Kirbishley.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good news again on a Monday that you're going to show up for a change. Alan, thank you very much for agreeing to come on the podcast this week. Hopefully it won't be too hard. You should know the answer to most of these questions, as they are about you. So we want to get a little bit under the skin of some of the great, wonderful things you've done in your long career at this stage. But I feel like we're kind of lucky enough to have you, actually, because it's so long since you've been in management at this stage, despite all the success you had. I was kind of starting to think perhaps you didn't like doing interviews.
Well, no, I think it's gone quickly, funny enough. And when I left West Ham, I was warned by Alec Ferguson that not to be out too long, and because you're quickly forgotten, and that's what happened in some respects. You know, I was offered a situation to come back in. I didn't think they were quite right, and then suddenly a year turned into another year, and then suddenly you're out of favour, and you're not on people's lips.
But it's funny enough, actually, just as an aside, as coming from a betting firm's perspective, your name seemed to be in the top kind of half dozen for every single job that came up in the Premier League or whatever. Kirbishley was always in there, about third or fourth favourite. But anyway, I want to start here with the highlight of your career, without a doubt, which clearly was starring in our pundit series. have you planned your Oscars acceptance speech just yet?
Well, I did get one comment from someone I know who said, "You might as well. Why don't you forget about becoming a manager of a football club and go and manage the Queen Vic in EastEnders, because that's what you're much more suited to after the pundits episode one."
Yeah, because I tell you what, you were bloody good at acting. Like, don't mean you were. You obviously are very good at acting. Like, why is it taking this long to show? Have you never had an opportunity? I know you've been on TV loads as a pundit, but I mean, have you ever had the opportunity before, and did you enjoy it?
No, I've never had the opportunity before. I think I've done a couple of little things in the Dream Team when that came out a million years ago.
Remember that? Jesus, yeah.
That was a great show. That was.
I think once I got with Tomo and Letizia and Charlie Nicholas, it was. Quite good fun, actually. We enjoyed it. And I think that you could see that by some of the outtakes.
Would you say, you touched on it there, but like, say, going back to football for a minute, is there a reason why? Have you made a conscious decision to step away? And I had the brief little kind of fortnight at Fulham or whatever it was, a very short period of Fulham there. But have you kind of said, you know what, done that, moved on, time for something else? Or would you be open to maybe going back, or do you still? I mean, what, I don't even know what to do. Do you send in CVs anymore? How do you apply for jobs even?
Well, no, I think what happened when I left West Ham, I got involved in a bit of a court case that dragged on. The Premier League wasn't quite ready for managers that resigned as opposed to managers getting sacked, and so it dragged on some time. It shouldn't have dragged on as long as it did. And as I say, when I came out, I was offered opportunities. There's no denying that. It was, you know, some championship clubs, and it was clubs in the Premier League in a relegation battle with 10 or 12 games to go. And I was holding out for something better. I'd been in the Premier League for 10 years. You know, I had 300 odd games as a manager in the Premier League, and I thought something better would come along. And as I said, Alec kept saying to me, you know, you look at the other managers of my generation, Sam Allardyce and David Moyes especially, and Tony Pulis, and I think Stevie Bruce, you know, when they leave a job, they basically try and jump back in as quick as they can. May not be the right one in some respects, but just to get back in there. And as I say, the longer you're out, the more you're forgotten. And I think that's what basically happened to me.
And do you like have a, I'm sure, like, I mean, Wikipedia is a decent enough CV for you, but do you have like a CV done up and you're ready to go? And like, I don't know, is it like, for example, if a position comes up, is it, do they give you a ring, or do you kind of, like, I mean, I presume like that's a part of the reason for staying relevant and jumping back into jobs is that you're always, like I said, I was slagging you earlier saying you're always in the list for betting on next manager or whatever. So you're always relevant. But then if you wanted to jump back in now, you'd a bit of uphill, a bit of work to do, wouldn't it be, to get yourself in front of the board and all that kind of thing?
Absolutely, because I think things have moved on so much. I mean, it's not as if you've been on Mars and you've not been around. Obviously, I've been doing a lot of punditry and et cetera. But no, things have moved on and there's new owners, a new group of agents, if you like, that you've got no, you know, you've got no, what's the word? I think I'm looking for a relationship, if you like.
But, yeah.
The reason that I was getting linked with jobs is because, as I said earlier, I've done 10 years in the Premier League. Not many managers get to do that. It's a short-term job, normally. And, you know, my win ratio was good. And I think that up until last year, I think I was still in the top 10 of appearances in the Premier League. And I think because Roy Hodgson and Jose Mourinho survived, they overtook me. So now I think I'm number 12. No, I've been out too long. So you did mention Fulham there, where I went back as perhaps a consultant to Rennie Mullerstein, which I thought was a good idea at the time, because he took over Fulham, never been a manager before, and he wanted a bit of experience around him. So me and Ray Wilkins went in, actually. But it only lasted a month, and they changed it around and brought Felix McGat in, and we all left.
This New Year's Day, Paddy Power want to make one lucky punter a millionaire. Just opt in on the Paddy Power app and back one winner on any of the selected qualifying races in the six-week run-up starting at Cheltenham on November the 14th. Pick one winner, win 1 million. Not a bad way to ring in the new year. Well, it beats the hootenanny and a dodgy curry anyway. To enter and to find out more, visit paddypower.com. Paddy Power. T's and C's apply. Excludes shops. Selected markets only. Minimum £5 stake. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Alan, you're on about getting back in, but to get back in, do you think, I know you read about guys having to do their coaching badges and all of that kind of stuff to get into management. Would if you were to get back in, would you have to go and almost do a refresher course, or would you trust your own instinct on the way the game is played?
No, I'd have to look at what's going on, because let me tell you, we wasn't playing out from the back when I was managing. And wasn't asking goalkeepers to be the midfield dynamos, if you like, and flick it round the corner and get it back. And, you know, it's a totally different game now, and I understand that. But I've seen the managers, as I said earlier, my era, you know, not so much Sam now, but obviously David Moyes and Stevie Bruce, etc., that have adapted. So I don't think it would have took that long. But as I said earlier, it's... it's being in the know. It's knowing the agents now. It's obviously the owners. I mean, owners are changing all the time. And especially at the moment, when they come into a football club, they bring their own people. And so, you know, as I said earlier, you have to be in the loop, really, to have a chance of getting a job. And the longer you're out, the worse it gets for you. That's why, as I said earlier, managers try and jump back in. They call it the merry-go-round. But get back in as soon as you can, because you're back in. And then some of it may lead from there, you know.
We know you're on pretty good terms with Alex Ferguson, and he said to put your name forward for the United job, and he was retiring. Did you ever ask him, did you really put it forward, or was that just a statement?
To be fair, that's the first... I read that somewhere, it was about a couple of months ago, and it's the first I'd known about it. But no, I didn't bother him with that at the moment. But, you know, I think the thing for me at the time... at Charlton, we were doing great things, if you like. And, you know, I'd been on an interview for the England job, which, along with Sam Allardyce and I think Steve McLaren and a few others, and it went to Steve McLaren. So at the time, you know, I was perhaps in the frame for one or two things. Not quite sure if it was all true, but obviously, when you're in the loop, you know, you're on people's lips.
Can I ask you a question? You said there, I'm not sure if it's all true. How much is the rumor mill in play for you as an applicant for a job? Are you hearing things, whispers on the wind, that sort of stuff? Is that a big factor?
Well, not hearing it now, but obviously when I left West Ham and for quite a few years, I was always getting linked with things which I didn't know anything about and was frequently asked. And I said, look, there's been no contact. But I was offered, I can't deny that, I was offered jobs, which I thought at the time wasn't right, and decided that I was waiting for the one that really attracted me. And it never quite came along. And as I said earlier, the longer you're out, the worse it gets for you. And I was leading a different life, if you like. And you know, I was doing the TV work for the Premier League, the overseas, right? So I was doing quite a bit of that. And then suddenly you're out of that lifestyle, and it's very, very difficult to get back into it.
There's a bit of showbiz to it, isn't there? I mean, so I always think, I don't mean to sound all Brexity, but like foreign managers, exotic names are kind of, I don't know, overrated, I guess, in the same way as English players are often overrated because of the next big thing. And if like a Ross Barkley was Ross Barkley off or something like that, he mightn't be quite the big deal. Do you know that kind of way? And there is a bit of that kind of like a football fan loves the idea of, like, it's human nature, I guess. Something that you don't know is probably deadly. Like, it's just that dream, you know?
It was a little bit sexy, wasn't it? Bringing in the foreign coach or the foreign manager and at first. And then we had a little spell. I think certain countries got picked on. You know, suddenly come from Portugal, then Spain, and perhaps Germany, etc. But I'm quite pleased at the moment that there's a good sprinkling of British managers in the Premier League, I must admit. A bit disappointed that a couple of them are down the bottom there at the moment. But, you know, it has coincided, I think, with quite a bit of foreign ownership. And, you know, so the British manager has had to fight back. And, you know, I'm glad to see that there is, as I said, a sprinkling. But the only way the British manager could get in the Premier League was actually taking a team into the Premier League from the Championship and staying there. That was the only route that we had. And, we've, you know, as I said, myself, Stevie Bruce and Sam, etc., we all done that. And managed to stay there, and you know, but thankfully at the moment the British manager is getting a bit more of a looking in the Premier League.
So you listen to David Moyes, or not, it was actually Chris Wilder talking about it, but David Moyes going into his office last week after a match and discussing Sheffield United's bad run of form. I know meat managers do generally have a drink with each other after a game. Would you have discussed how someone else's team was going? I found that interesting that David Moyes was giving Chris Wilder advice.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there is a, you know, everybody talks about having a drink afterwards, and the farm manager didn't quite understand that, especially people like Arsene Wenger and Rafa Benitez and Gerard Houllier. They didn't really understand it, and I think that the people around them, the coaches at their club, sort of explained it to them that it was, you know, a thing to do. I mean, there were sometimes when they didn't shake your hand after a game, because in Europe that wasn't a done thing. And I think, you know, Mourinho got involved, and it's eased up somewhat. I'm not too sure what it's like now, but you know, I quite liked giving in the room afterwards, especially if you beat one of the big clubs, because you ended up, you know, when they've whacked you most weeks, you have to go in there and listen to it and suck eggs a little bit. But then when you turn the tables and little old Charlton done the double over one or two of them, I went looking for them, actually. You know, I went looking for the manager to have a drink because I was going to enjoy it.
Funny on that, because I know you're talking about United there as one of the victims along the way, but you're reportedly on pretty good terms with Fergie, and they say that he put your name forward as one of the replacements for him when he left United. I mean, was that... But like, what was it like taking a team to United, and obviously getting a great result there was brilliant. But like, how was Fergie afterwards? Was he as friendly, or was he kind of gritting teeth?
It's a big thing with Charlton fans. I think I had 14 attempts of trying to take someone from Man United and got nothing. And then I went to West Ham and won 3 on the spin, which was really enjoyable, I must admit. But no, he was always, obviously, he'd always be quite happy after a game, because, you know, he normally won them. But he was gracious when I ended up getting the result. But you always got a decent glass of wine. You know, he made sure that there was a decent bottle there. And, you know, there are some funny stories where managers have tried to replicate and give him a bottle of wine, and it just ain't worked out. You know, it's been a bottle of plonk from Sainsbury's or something. You know, it ain't quite worked out. But I think he was instrumental. I think in that sort of after game routine and the Liverpool boys. But as I say, mostly because I was in good moods because they'd won.
What about losers? Who were the worst losers? Which managers did were just there was no point in going for the drink?
Yeah, there's a few. As I said, I think Arsene Wenger will forgive me, but we won 4-2 at Highbury, and Pat Rice, his assistant, was always the guy that, you know, invited you in and poured you out a drink. But when we won, Charlton won 4-2 at Highbury one year, and it was against the odds, and they had about 20 odd shots, and Omri hit the post and hit the bar and missed a few sitters, etc. But we won it. So I was well pleased to go in the dressing room at Highbury, but there was no Arsene. I couldn't find him at all. Actually didn't see him at all, so I thought that was a bit down, and I'll let Pat Rice know about it as well.
Yeah, that's typical. But moving away from club football into international football, the English job, who approached you? How does one get the English job?
Well, what happened, I think Sven Gornhausen was leaving, and they threw up a shortlist, the AFA, and as I said, I think, you know, it was definitely Sam and definitely obviously Steve McLaren, myself, I think Scolari was in it somewhere, I'm not too sure. And Martin O'Neill, I think, was in it in the interviews. But what happened, it was during the season, and they wanted to interview us on a Tuesday or something like that, in a secret venue. And I couldn't go because I had an FA Cup replay. So I missed that one, and I think my interview was hastily arranged at the FA and et cetera. But, you know, it eventually went to Steve McLaren, which I thought he would do because he'd been working with Sven, and he knew the setup. But I was pleased to go on the interviews and actually be recognised as part of it. But I didn't think I had much chance of getting it, to be honest.
What is the interview for the English job like, though? Is it like you just turn up and go, "How's it going, lads? I'm Alan in your new suit or your dad's suit or whatever"? Or is this, do you have to go in and present, do a PowerPoint, and is like say, "I think we should change the structure and we should have whatever, and I want to play 4-4-2 or whatever"?
That was the deal that you had to present to them. One of the things was, you know, you've got an international week or, you know, two games, whatever. Just gone through recently, you know, and you have to talk about call-ups and, you know, first stage training and what you're going to do and how you're going to keep the players happy or involved for the 8 or 10 days. And, you know, the first game would be away from home, so how are you going to plan for it, and, you know, the video work and what sort of training you're going to do, and et cetera, et cetera. So it was quite in-depth. You know, that was one of the things that they wanted, as I say, an international break of 10 days and two games, and how he was going to plan for that. And, you know, how you was going to attack the job, and what was you looking to improve on, what you felt was good and what you thought was bad about the England situation. So it was quite in-depth. As I say, I had never got the chance to do it as thoroughly as the others, because I had a game. So, you know, that was a little bit disappointing. But as I say, I didn't think that I was going to be involved that much.
Obviously, yes, Steve McLaren was Sven's assistant at the time, but Sam Allardyce was interviewed as well. When did they let you know you weren't getting the job, or was it just announced that Steve McLaren was?
No, I got told. And obviously the people at the club had to know, my chairman had to know at the time. And, you know, actually the publicity around it wasn't very good because, for me at the time, because I had 1 year left on my contract at Charlton. The club wanted me to sign a three-year deal. And, you know, I'd been there for 15, 16 years, and I was a bit wary of signing a longer-term deal. I was happy. There was no problems with it. You know, I felt perhaps I'd do the year and then decide what I wanted to do and let my contract run out, which became a problem because, quite right, the chairman at the time at Charlton was coming near the end of the season, and he felt that if I was trying to sign players on 3 or 4 year contracts and I only had one, and the fact that players were asking that, you know, how long is the manager going to be around for, etc. It was causing a problem. And that was perhaps one of the reasons that it was decided that, that I left, that, you know, because I wasn't going to commit my long-term future, that I think the club felt it was, you know, not the right thing. So things escalated from there, and then suddenly I was leaving.
Do you not think, though, I mean, or is it, in hindsight, is it the right thing? Because they always say, like, you know, in, as someone who's worked at the same place for 25 years, but they always say that, like, you know, there's a sweet spot of about 5 or 6 or 7 years or something, and then it's good time to freshen up. Do you know what I mean? It's time to freshen up. Like, so did you stay too long at Charlton, do you think, or... Like from your perspective and from the club's perspective, or the no regrets?
No, I don't think I don't think that I've been there too long, because we went through a real process of going back to the stadium, building a stadium, you know, getting ourselves in the Premier League and staying there. And we was attracting different quality players, and you know, so no disrespect, but you know, a long time I was perhaps shopping at Sainsbury's, but then I had an opportunity to go to Waitrose or Harrods, you know, because things had changed. But I had done nearly 16 years, and you know, it wasn't just me. Perhaps the fans got a bit tired of hearing my voice, or etc. But it just worked that you know, in the discussions I was having, you know, I was keen. I think we had 2 weeks left of the season, and I was keen on trying to sign a couple of players, and we'd already made inroads into that. Like we always did, we'd like to end the season at Charlton by signing someone to give everyone a lift. But then the question came up, you know, you're trying to sign this player for X amount of money, and you know, you want to put him on a 4-year deal, and he's your player, but you might not be around, you know. So I understood the argument, and you know, so that was the reason, I think the main reason why I left the club. It wasn't that I'd been there that long, it's just that I wasn't committing myself to a longer term future.
So you're gone from Charlton. Alan Pardew gets gate in West Ham. You're a fan of West Ham. It was a boyhood dream. You must have loved the thought of it. But did you think the West Ham fans fully accepted you as a West Ham guy, considering how associated you were with Charlton?
It was interesting, yeah, because so I left Charlton and had 4 or 5 months out. And Alan Pardew actually was one of my first signings at Charlton when I took over, so I did really well. But he was having a bad time, and obviously I could see that. And then when they decided to make a change, I was available, and sometimes you're in the right place at the right time. I was available. There was no compensation because I was a free agent. And I think a lot of people, especially the Icelandic owners at the time, thought perhaps this is a perfect fit. I was going back to my club. That was a terrific ex-player. I wasn't going back like, you know, an icon, if you like. I was going back as a manager who had 15 years experience. And that's the way I looked at it. I walked into a difficult situation. The team was in the bottom three, and we were struggling a bit. And it took me a long time to get to grips with it, I must admit. But thankfully, we got out of it. Everyone remembers, as you said, the last game at Old Trafford and et cetera. But, you know, we was too good. The team was too good, I thought, to go down. I always thought that we would get out of it, but it was tricky for a long period. But yeah, the West Ham fans, I think, at the time, probably thought that Alan Pardew would have been given a bit more time, and perhaps that may have been the case. But when decisions are made, they're made. And, you know, when they approached me, it was the perfect job.
Tevez obviously scored that winner at Old Trafford, which was pretty dramatic. What was he like? He seemed a bit of a character, Tevez. And that was like an unusual situation at the time. Was that tricky to manage? Or?
Well, I walked in, and Tevez and Mascherano was obviously there and not playing. Mascherano was injured and at the time. So I went in, I think, middle of December, and obviously the transfer window was opening up in January. So I called them both in, and, you know, via an interpreter, and sort of said, you know, what's your plans? What are you thinking? Because they'd hardly played any football, etc. And Mascherano hinted that he wanted to leave. But Carlos said that he was happy at the club, even though he wasn't playing at the time. And it was obviously a bit tricky because they'd come into the club and there was the rule that you couldn't move, you know, to another club in a certain amount of time and etc. But Carlos was happy to stay. And after about 4 or 5 weeks at the club, I decided to play him alongside Bobby Zamora. And the thing clicked. And, you know, we started turning it around a little bit. And, you know, everyone talks about the last game at Old Trafford, which was fine. It was a game that we needed to take something from, obviously, because I think Sheffield United were playing Wigan, so that would someone if got beat there would be in trouble. But if you look at the run we had, it was an incredible run. We won 7 games out of 9, and lots of people obviously talk about Carlos, but it was a settled side, and I think we won 5 games with clean sheets. So everyone played their part, and I think in the run-in, that run-in, I only used 13 players. So that was a big difference to when I walked in, where the team was changing constantly because we was getting beat.
Alan, you mentioned there the thing clicking when you introduced Tevez back into the side. That must be incredibly satisfying for the manager, really, because the fans aren't happy. They're baying for blood. The owners aren't happy. We all know patience isn't exactly a word that's used in football too often. When you can get the result that relieves that pressure and all of a sudden the system comes together and it's all down to you making a change, that must be a really, really good feeling.
Well, what happened was we played Spurs at home. And Carlos scored his first goal, if you can believe it. I think it was his first goal in 20 games. I mean, how can Carlos Tevez go 20 games without scoring? But he scored and we was winning 3-2 with like 4 or 5 minutes to go and ended up getting beat 4-3. So I've come out of that ground, obviously gutted. We were 10 points behind, I think, with 9 games to go or something. But as I come out of the ground and got into my car, it was the first time that, because it was a decent performance and et cetera, that I knew I was going to keep the same side for the following week. Whereas normally when you've been beat and you're having a bad run, you're driving home thinking, I might change that, I might do this. And you're thinking about Monday, thinking about the training during the week. And, you know, if you're going to make changes, how you introduce them, if you're going to drop someone big, you're going to have to handle that one, et cetera. But it was for the first time that I knew that I could keep the same team. And we went to Blackburn and we luckily scraped a 2-1 win. And I think we got a penalty, which Carlos took, I think, and scored. And we actually scored a goal that I don't think actually went over the line. That was before goal line technology. And we won it 2-1. And suddenly, it gave me the opportunity again that I could go through the following week more confidence in the team, and the players are more confident. And that's when we went on that run. And as I say, I used 13 players. So it probably clicked because we got beat against Spurs, which is, if you ask any West Ham fan, it's the big, you know, the big rivals, apart from Millwall, et cetera. But Spurs is the big rivals in London. And we got beat, but that was a turning point of that great escape.
So you won 7 of the last 9. Carlos Tevez scored the winner in Old Trafford. But as a United fan, my memory of it is your celebration as you're running down the pitch. But then you have to look at Neil Warnock even, and his reaction when Sheffield United went down the same day. Did you ever have that conversation with Neil Warnock? Or do you have any sympathy for him?
Yeah, I have. And he was very critical of Alex's team selection that day. But he also forgot a couple of things, which I pointed out to him, that Liverpool went to Fulham with the second from last game, and Fulham were in it as well. And that was in the European Cup final, and I think. And Rafa Benitez made 10 changes, and they got beat 1-0 by Fulham, which gave Fulham a big boost. And the result probably kept them up. And Sheffield United beat West Ham 2-0 at Bramall Lane on a Saturday. And as I say, I think they were 10 points clear of us at the time. And then on the Tuesday, we both had games. We had Chelsea at home and they had Man United away. And I think Neil made 5 or 6 changes to go to Old Trafford and got beat. We played Chelsea and got beat. And then the following Saturday, Sheffield United went to Charlton, which was a relegation battle. And Neil restored his team. And I think he forgot that he played a weakened side at Old Trafford on the Tuesday. And perhaps Jose Mourinho should have had the hump a little bit. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts. I think the team that Alex put out against us was a massively strong side. And I think my memory of the game at half time was Stratford End singing "Send them down, send them down, send them down," because there was a history between West Ham and Man United where West Ham beat Man United last game of the season and Blackburn won the title.
Oh, I remember. I remember. Yeah.
And the West Ham players and fans apparently celebrated over the top a little bit. And I think the Man United boys remember that, and Fergie did. So, no, I, you know, at the end of the day, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think our result didn't matter too much at Old Trafford because of the result at Wigan and Sheffield United. Yeah. But there was a big thing about weakened teams going on. I think Mick McCarthy got fined for playing a weakened team. And, you know, it's something that won't even come into it now because the squads are so strong that you'd be saying, you know, how can you say that's a weakened team? But as I say, I think Neil forgot a little bit that he actually did that in midweek against Man United himself.
I'd say Neil took that really well when you pointed it out to him as well, did he?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. But I've seen him since. And there was a big thing, obviously, wasn't there? Sheffield United being relegated and, you know, taking West Ham to court, etc. You know, so there was a big thing going on at the time.
Here at Paddy Power, we want our gambling to be fun and encourage our customers to bet responsibly. That's why we offer a number of tools to help you stay in control, including the ability to set deposit limits, get reminders after a certain amount of time playing, and to take breaks. For more information, visit responsiblegaming.paddypower.com. 18+, begambleaware.org.
Speaking of drama and kind of feeling sorry for manager, having sympathy for managers, your Charlton team featured in what must get, has to go down as one of the most dramatic playoff finals of all time at Wembley in 98 when it was 4-4, it wasn't a normal time, and you won 7-6 on penalties to go up in that, whatever they call it, the billion-dollar game, whatever the hell it is they call it these days. But, like, what do you say to Peter Reid after that? Is it like, sorry about that? Or, like, is it like, ah, well, best man won type of thing? Or
no, I've known Peter since under 21 days, you know, he's a year older than me, so I basically grew up with him, if you like, and we were friends, and we still are. And, you know, before the game, it was funny, because you're at Wembley, you've not got your own little office. If he was at Sunderland, he'd have his office. If he was at Charlton, he'd have a cup of tea if he was going to have a little chat. But we actually sat out on the pitch in the tunnel watching the warm-ups, and we're just having a chat like normal, you know, and all the best, and I'll see you afterwards. I must admit, after the game, he came into our dressing room and gave a little speech, and was really good. And I couldn't imagine me doing it, I must admit. But he came in and congratulated us. And I always thought about that game before it, that we had to win it. Charlton had to win it, because I knew if we didn't win it, the team would be broken up. I knew that there'd be people coming in for my players. And I knew that we had to win it. And I knew that Sunderland would bounce back from it, if you know what I mean. There was a strong side, strong club. And so it had to be our time. And funny enough, they did bounce back. They won promotion the next season. But I think that if we'd have lost that game, I don't think it would have been the same for me at Charlton or the players. We had to win it.
Was that the biggest win of your career, the best day as a manager, or was there a better day?
No, I think that put everybody on the map. I think if you win that playoff final and get promoted to the Premier League, it puts everybody on the map. And, you know, the team, the club now was fully restored, if you like, because of the drama that the club had, leaving the Valley and going to Selhurst Park for 5 or 6 years, then going to Upton Park for 18 months and eventually getting back to the Valley. You know, it put us back on the map as a football club. And, you know, it was the beginning of something terrific for everybody connected with the club.
There's a few things about management that I've always wondered, right? I know you've got loads of assistants and you've got a team around you, but do you have to go out and do some homework? Like, do you go out and watch many games when you're not involved? Like, I know you always have a game, but would you watch the midweek games when you're not playing, all that kind of stuff, and you're always taking notes?
I think the manager's role has changed now dramatically, but, you know, when I was managing, and you talk, I keep bringing up the Allardyces and the Bruces, etc., and the Moyeses, No, you'll be watching the academy games. You'll be watching the under-21 games or reserve games, if you like. You'll be watching the opposition. You'll be doing most things at a football club. Now, a lot of it is delegated and it's presented to the manager to decide what he wants to do with it. But when I was managing, he was doing a lot and he was involved in basically most aspects of the club. Obviously, the most important aspect would be managing the team, but you'd be involved in scouting the players, bringing the players in, deciding to let players go. Well, I think a lot of that side of it now is done by other people. So I think the biggest relationship in a football club at the moment is between the manager. It used to be the manager and the chairman. And that's why people say, make sure you get a good chairman. But it used to be the manager and the chairman because he was basically running the club. But now it's the manager and the sporting director and perhaps then the CEO. It's a different route now. But no, you'd go to a midweek game back in the day and all the managers be there because they're not only just looking at the opposition, but they're looking at future signings, etc. So the workload was tremendous. I think they've got it, apart from getting a lot more money, I think they've got it easier as well at the moment, the manager, because they can delegate. It's become the norm. It's become perhaps the foreign manager, the European way of managing, if you like, as opposed to the British way.
And transfer-wise then, how long would you watch a player before you'd sign him for? Would you be looking at him for months, weeks, or just decide, you know what, see him once, he'll do me?
No. I used to have to present at least four or five reports that I personally had seen the player to the board of Charlton. And obviously I'd be recommended the player by your scouts or your international scouts, domestic scouts. And obviously, you'll know a bit more about the domestic players. But I had to, prove, if you like, that, and I thought that was right. But if I wanted to sign Billy Smith from X club, etc., for a lot of money, I had to prove that I'd done my homework. And I didn't think that was a problem. But obviously, now it's a little bit different. But if I was looking at a foreign player, I'd regularly go to France, which was, for me to get to France, Lyon and Lens is like 3 hours from where I am at the moment. It takes me that to get to Birmingham if I want to go and watch someone. So most weekends, if we wasn't playing on a Sunday, then I'd slip over to France or Holland or Italy even, if I was looking at a player, to get that opportunity to see him playing at home and playing away. I like to watch him playing away, especially away from home.
Why did away make such a difference?
Well, because it's a little bit more difficult, I think, away games. Doesn't seem that at the moment because of the lack of crowds, but let me tell you, it's a big difference. And you've got to have a different mentality away from home, especially if you're a defender. And so if I was looking at a player, I'd like to make sure that I'd seen him in an away game, especially.
And if you're, just say you decide on the player, are you involved in how much you pay for him, or is it just, okay, we want Ruby Walsh, and you say to the chairman, get me Ruby Walsh type of thing, and the chairman goes off and comes back and says, we couldn't get him, he's too expensive? Or do you say, I think he's worth a tenner or whatever?
We used to, in my era, you used to make the first contact. You'd phone the opposition manager and say, look, you probably don't want to hear this, but I'm interested in so-and-so. And they'd probably give you a straight answer, well, you're not going to get him, or he's going to cost you a lot of money, or yeah, you can have it, whatever. Yeah. So once I made that contact, then I went to the chairman and said, look, I'm interested. I've been given a nod. You better talk to your opposite number and try and work out some sort of deal. And I always thought the way that transfer were done then, because then if you agreed a transfer fee, then obviously the opposing manager would talk to the player and say, look, we've accepted this fee. Are you interested in going to Charlton or West Ham or whatever? And then contact is made, but then you'd sort of talk to the player, convince him if you had to come to your club and why you wanted him and what your plans were and who else you were going to bring in, etc. Then you sort of talk terms, and then you've done the medical last. And I always thought that was a strange way around, because if you'd agreed everything, the fee and the fee and the in the personal terms, and then something went wrong with the medical. It suddenly became really public because it had gone so far, people had learned about it, and I thought it was always detrimental to the player. So what we did in the end, we sort of tried to get the medical done first. And so if there was a problem with the medical, then perhaps the player could get on with his life, if you know what I mean. And either he decided to sign him or he went back to his club, and there wasn't a lot of talk about medicals because it can obviously be a problem. So, but as I say, in my era, he was involved in every stage of it, really. I don't think that's the same now.
It's the same with horses. You make an offer, you buy the horse, and then they vet it. You mightn't even know if it's sound. It's still done the very same way. But then, just while we're on managing, the only other thing, how much influence can you have at halftime? Or what can you do with a halftime team talk? Surely most tactics, etc., are done well before a match. What can you actually do in a halftime team talk?
Yeah, because things have changed, haven't they? You've gone into a game, and this is your plan, etc. This is what you think they're going to be good at and bad at, the opposition, whatever. And the whole thing changes by half-time because you're one down or two down or you've had an injury. I always used to let the players go into the dressing room. And, you know, because if it's not going swell, they could be having a little bit of a go at each other. Everyone could be a little bit angry with what's going on. And then I'd stand outside with my assistant and make sure I got it right. You know, I always thought that I always used to sit upstairs for the first half so I could watch the game and wasn't downstairs. And I always thought it was difficult for managers being downstairs to actually see the big picture of what perhaps was going on. And I wanted to make sure that what I saw was right. If I'm going to go in and blame someone for something, I wanted to make sure I was right, because there's plenty of occasions you can go in and blame someone and the problem was like two or three steps before. But no, it is important. And what is most important is not to go in there and throw the teacups about if it's not going so well and scream and shout and actually not get your point across. I think players generally, if someone's not doing it or someone's been at fault, they like to see them fingered. You know, they like to see them pulled up and criticised. But you can't go too overboard because you're going to lose them in that five minutes you've got. And, you know, so the first thing I'd do is talk to my assistant. Then the physio would come out and tell me that everyone was okay still, because it's no good me going in saying, well, I'm going to do this and do that and one of them's injured. I've not seen that. So I used to go in calm and collect. I mean, obviously, if you talk to some of my ex-players, you know, I can lose it like the best of them. But I think that you have to make sure you've got your facts straight and get your message across. So half-time is important. I think as a team, I always used to make sure that my team knew they were playing. Maybe Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon, they knew the team. And so that meant I could have a relaxed Friday. We'd done all the work, if you like, and then on Friday it'd be quite relaxed. And if I've left anybody out, they knew Thursday afternoon, and they could come in on Friday. And if they were still unhappy about it, then I would know and I could leave them out completely. If they wasn't in the right frame of mind to be in the squad, then that's fine. I'd give them enough time to get over the shock of being left out. But if they come in on Friday and they're still down, then I knew that they're not going to be involved. So they didn't want no miserable faces around the squad match day. So I always tried to do that as best I could. I always used to try and give them the team by Friday so they knew. Thursday afternoon, Friday morning. Well, I know a lot of managers announce the team an hour and a half before the game. And I couldn't quite understand that, because if you was making a big decision, you didn't want a confrontation 90 minutes before the game. You know, a player reacting badly to being left out. I think the people that announced their teams on a Saturday afternoon was the big ones. You know, the top four, that they would announce their team and then go and win, right? So no one could have an argument. But if you announce your team with a couple of changes and you get beat, then you get a knock on the door on a Monday morning, you know? So I tried to avoid match day confrontations as much as I could.
Okay, well, that's all well and good now. But the real reason you're here, Alan, is because we have a very important quiz at the end of all these features of our podcast. The good news is we're coming towards the end, so you can relax. But so you get a choice. Ruby Walsh, obviously this really clever connection with racing. We call this quiz. You have a choice to take jumps questions or flat questions. The flat questions are easier. The jumps questions are more difficult, but much more interesting. So we will give you the choice. Just to let you know, every guest we've had so far has chosen jumps. So we'll just give you the choice. You can choose jumps or flat.
So you're leading me into jumps.
Yeah, but I think it should.
We're not leading it. We're going to push you if you don't choose.
Well,
anyway.
You know, to be perfectly honest, there are no flat questions.
Politely telling you, Alan, as opposed to leading you. Just politely telling you.
Funny enough, I had a similar thing with Alan Brazil on TalkSport one morning. Because we're all the same age group. And he wanted to give me a quiz.
Yeah.
And it all come from me as, you know, this is what we're gonna ask you some questions in a minute. It's Alan's quiz. And I went, well, no one told me about that, but let me ask him a few questions. And I spun it on him. And it was quite interesting, the answers I got. But we might talk about that later, if you want. But I asked him questions like, if he was playing now, what tattoo would you have? And I won't tell you what he said. And I said, if you were playing now, how much money would you be on? And it blew his head off that he thought he could have been on much money. And if he was playing now, what colour boots would you be wearing? Because everyone else was, in our day, just wore black.
Yeah.
And that was it. And, you know, so I got some interesting questions. And, you know, when you talk to my era, they're the sort of questions you should ask them.
Right. Well, they might be trickier than that, Alan. But so, Ruby, take it away. We're going to give you a jump.
I'll go for the jump.
Yeah, and I'm going to go first. What is your biggest regret in football?
Leaving West Ham when I did, because I thought I had a good side that finished 10th. We started the season, although we only played a handful of games, it was in the top five. And I just think that I had a chance of doing well. And so that's my biggest regret, leaving West Ham when I did.
Okay. Would you ever go back to help Charlton if they came knocking now?
I would if I was asked. Lee Bowyer is one of my ex-players. I actually sold Lee to Leeds when he was a teenager to help us build a stand, which is what we was doing at the time. And obviously I know him quite well. I had him at West Ham. And I've been over there a couple of times before the lockdown, since he's been the manager. So if I was asked in any capacity, yeah, I would. I would go and try and help if they thought it would help him. No problem.
But it's been 12 years since you last managed, and our extensive team of researchers at Paddy Power have trawled through all articles, Wikipedia, you name it, and there is no official announcement of your retirement. Would you like to give us the scoop?
Yeah, no. As I said earlier, when you was late for the interview, Ruby, and I hope the boys find you appropriately, I haven't been on Mars. I haven't been locked away somewhere, so I don't know what's going on. And as I say, I do a lot of work for the Premier League in terms of the overseas rights. So I think it's different, as I said earlier, but not that much different. I think I could fit back in quite easily.
Well said, Alan.
That's an order.
Thank you very much for your time, and we'll talk to you again soon. Righto, that's all we've got time for on today's show. My thanks to our special guest, Alan Kirbishley, and of course to Patrick and Rupert. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We're back on Friday with a busy tipping show ahead of another big weekend of National Hunt Racing. But for now, I've been Tom Nugent, and that was From the Horse's Mouth.